From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the bombing at an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester that killed 22 people and how it resonates in Boston. It's all part of our Week in Review. Also today...
Is the world truly ready for a vehicle that can drive itself? Ready or not, the future is here.
A new study out of MIT tries to gauge how the public feels about giving up control of their vehicles. And playwright and actor Obehi Janice on writing plays that resonate.
A woman grabs me and she's crying and she says, I was about to write your play, but you already did it.
That's coming up on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Friday and time for our Week in Review. And we start with the tragic bombing in Manchester on Monday night. Here's Prime Minister Theresa May.
All acts of terrorism are cowardly attacks on innocent people. But this attack stands out for its appalling, sickening cowardice, deliberately targeting innocent, defenseless children and young people who should have been enjoying one of the most memorable nights of their lives.
In Israel this week, President Trump reacted to news about the attackers.
I won't call them monsters because they would like that term. They would think that's a great name. I will call them, from now on, losers, because that's what they are. They're losers.
The youngest victim was Safi Roussos from Leyland. She was just 8 years old. Here's the headmaster of her school, Chris Upton.
Safi was simply a beautiful little girl in every aspect of the word. She was loved by everyone, and her warmth and kindness will be remembered fondly.
The Manchester attack in a stadium full of concertgoers is considered a soft target. And you know, we can't help but remember the Boston Marathon bombings just over 4 years ago, also in a place where people least expected. Joining us now to talk about this and all of the rest of this week's news is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscetti. Tom, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
And Reverend Mariama White Hammond. She's a minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. Thank you as well for coming in.
Thank you.
So we just played a piece of tape remembering the 8-year-old girl who died in the bombing. And, you know, it's hard not to think of Richard Martin, who was also 8 years old when he died in the Boston Marathon bombings, Martin Richard. You know, we were talking in the newsroom and some of the reporters that were out there reporting on the Boston Marathons say that this attack really resonates for them. It takes them back to what happened in Boston. When you all heard the attack, what was your first reaction? And did you think about some of the things that had happened here? Also, an attack, a soft target.
Yeah, I mean, I just think at the end of the day, it's just sad because and anybody who attacked that knew that there were going to be children there. Ariana Grande's, her crowd is young women and young people. And so, you know, you have to ask yourself what kind of person and what kind of state of mind would think that that was okay. I mean, how do you get to the point where you find that to be justified in any way?
Tom.
Yeah, it certainly brought me back to the Boston Marathon bombing and in very similar circumstances because you had a diverse crowd there, no idea of who was going to be killed. It was simply random. We certainly knew that there were going to be a lot of families there. And I think that the bombers themselves knew there were going to be a lot of families there. So it is definitely reminiscent. If, in fact, the Manchester bombing is either an act of ISIS or ISIS-inspired, it is, while depraved, and it really is depraved, it's not surprising because ISIS has made very clear that women and children are legitimate targets for its actions. And I think you saw that playing out in Manchester.
Here's what Governor Charlie Baker said about the attack.
I've three kids are in their 20s. If they'd been there, that's exactly the kind of event, the kind of concert they would have been at. And but it's a terrible tragedy, and just another example of why we need to continue to be vigilant as a country and as a community about domestic terrorism.
Both of you talked about specifically the target of children and families, and ISIS specifically targeting those type of groups. And taking us back to the Boston bombings, the marathon bombing, the psychological impact it has on people, the time it takes to really move through that and continue on as normal. I just wanted to talk to you guys about that. We've been talking so much about the men that were involved, but really the people and the aftermath for those folks.
Hmm. Well, you know, I worked for many years in Boston, where unfortunately I worked with a lot of young people who had lost friends to violence. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think this is very traumatic. What I think is hard and unfortunate, and I think was even challenging in the marathon bombing, is that many of the young people I work with already felt like they were living in a war zone. And that's unfortunately true in far too many parts of the world. So I think it's really important that we address this. I also think it's really important for us to recognize that way too many people in the world live in fear. And I think it is an opportunity for us to ask, what does it mean? How can we be communities that are even tighter, even closer? I remember the story, I think it actually was on BUR, of a woman in Newton whose son looked sort of like Joe Karsanayev. And she said it's the first time she recognized what it meant for other mothers to have their sons profiled. So I think, yes, we need to look at issues of security and be vigilant. But I also think it is an opportunity, if we take it, to feel the connection that other people have, people who are living in war-torn countries, people in our own country who are living in places where gun violence is real. And how can we continue to bridge those gaps and connect communities so we also don't have young men who are susceptible to be influenced to do these kinds of things, because some of them are also people that are falling between the cracks and then get influenced to get into these kind of dangerous organizations.
So I thought the interesting thing with the Boston Marathon bombings was, and it's hard to say that this is a good thing that comes out of something so evil, but it was a good thing, and that is that it brought the city together. There was the whole Boston Strong thing that these types of attacks, I imagine, can tear people apart and can make people afraid and timid.
And divisive,
But that didn't happen in Boston, and notably it didn't happen with David Ortiz making that very clear on at Fenway Park at one point, saying this is our expletive city. Mm. And I think you're going to see that happen in Manchester as well. You're already starting to see that happen. And I think it speaks to the quality of people being able to rise back and strike back in something like this, not by going out and killing and things like that, but really coming together as a people. And you wouldn't want this to have to be the incident to provoke that, but it's nice to see that that's the way people respond.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about details of the bomber. It has emerged that this man, Salim Abedi, is known to authorities. Here's British Home Security Amber Rudd in exchange with a reporter on Wednesday.
Was this man on the watch list, and why wasn't he being monitored?
Well, we do know that he was known up to a point to the intelligence services. I'm sure we'll get more information about him over the next few days and over the next few weeks.
Again, there are parallels in Boston. Mm-hmm. We were talking about Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and he was one of the on the two watch lists in 2012 that were supposed to alert authorities if he traveled overseas. Tom, you were talking a little bit about this. Your thoughts about these parallels that we're seeing happening over and over?
It's real easy to figure out what went wrong in retrospect. It's really hard in advance.
Right.
And the problem, I mean, we'll see what happened actually in Manchester. And, you know, certainly there will be lessons learned, as there were lessons learned from the Boston Marathon bombing. And yet it strikes me that in a free society, you can't just start rounding up everybody and watching everybody that might be on some – that might have given a bad thought out there, written something inappropriate, or someone might have said something about. So yeah, we could probably do a better job, but I'm wary about kind of going the opposite extreme, which is that suddenly everyone's under surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually heard something, and I believe it was in Belgium, where one of the things they were doing in some communities was trying to see if they could get social services to do some more follow-up with folks, that there seems to be a profile of sort of where people are in terms of their mental health and their level of isolation. And so they were doing work, actually, to identify young men who seemed isolated, who seemed susceptible for this, and figuring out how they could help them be more integrated into communities instead of... So I don't think we want to just start... I would not be behind locking people up before they've even done anything.
Right, to your point
but
about...
Yeah. If we can identify people who seem like they might be susceptible, are there supports, mental health supports, social service supports that we could give that would make them less likely to do that? And I think that that is a way to be preventative in a way that doesn't turn your country into a police state.
And getting to the root of the problem.
Exactly.
So when we start to think about, will this get better? On Wednesday, we spoke with Jessica Stern. She's a professor at the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. And she's also an expert on ISIS. Mm-hmm. And she talked about the attack in Manchester. And here's part of what she said to Meghna Chakrabarty.
We're not going to eradicate ISIS. That's not going to happen. What we're trying to do is destroy them in the territory they control. But they're already spreading. And there's the danger they will spread further.
So Stern also talked about this in the Boston Globe. She said that she believes it will get worse before it gets better. And so it really makes you wonder, like, we talk a lot about stamping out ISIS. And Tom, you brought this up in the beginning, stamping them out. But really, do we need to get to the root of the problem before we can say we'll eradicate the problem?
I mean, I think it's, you know, again, like I said, working here, there have been times where we believe we could arrest our way out of things, and it just never works. So if I believed it would work, maybe I'd be willing to you know, agree with it. But I just think if you have a root problem of people who are isolated with mental health challenges, being preyed on by a group that has a lot of people they can prey on, you've got to stop giving them the supply of disaffected young people to prey on. And then you might have some ability to take out those top leaders. Those people are probably too far gone in many instances for us to be able to help them. But you can't allow large numbers of young people to feel isolated, especially with the internet, and be very easy, you know, to recruit. Yeah, we've got to look at these root problems, or else I don't think we have any chance of winning.
Tom, do you agree with that?
Not completely. So I certainly agree that there have been a number of mass terrorist actions, shootings, particularly in the United States, where you can trace it back to people with mental illness. But I'm not comfortable, I'm not really sure I buy into the notion that the people who are part of ISIS are simply mentally ill. Mm. I think what's going on here is that ISIS is, in fact, losing on the battlefield. It's finding itself pushed increasingly out of the territory.
But Mariama, you're not saying they're all mentally ill.
No.
Right?
What I'm saying, your top people, these top guys, they're not suicide bombers. They're not mentally ill.
I'm not even sure I'm buying this. I mean, I think I don't think it's mental illness. I think there are people who are attracted to the ideology. And to simply say, oh, if you're attracted to the ideology, you're mentally ill, is, I think, not to understand the power of the ideology.
I think disaffected doesn't just mean mentally ill. I'm not saying that people are all have schizophrenia. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I've worked with and met young people who, the more isolated that they get, right, end up joining gangs where you're saying, how is this actually moving your life forward? And the things they will tell you is, well, they care about me. This is my family. These people. And I'm saying, if they had had healthy supports on the other side, I'm not sure they would have chosen an organization to be part of it that put their very life at risk. So I'm not saying everyone's schizophrenic. What I'm saying is, people are in a place where they are more and more isolated. They're looking for somebody to love them and accept them. and ISIS says they will.
Right. But in the Manchester case, we're not seeing an isolated person. We're seeing an entire family. Mm-hmm. And it appears to the authorities that there were a number of people involved, mm-hmm. that this was organized, mm-hmm. And that some of them were related to each other. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure we can simply say, well, this is someone who is so isolated and disaffected. I think these were people who were followers of ISIS, and they actually bought into the ideology mm-hmm. of it. And as ISIS is dying on the battlefield, it's flailing about and having much more in terms of these mm-hmm. terrorist actions that it's trying to provoke overseas.
Okay, so let's make a turn. We're going to make like a huge turn to education now. And there's been a lot of education news this week. So we'll first start off with what happened with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. She testified before the House Appropriations Committee on Wednesday about the Trump administration's plan to cut more than 13% of the education budget while boosting spending for vouchers and programs that promote school choice. And Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark, have you guys seen? She asked DeVos if federal funds should go to private schools that also might refuse admission to students if they or their families are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. And Secretary DeVos responded that for states that have programs allowing parents to make choices, they set up the rules around that. So Clark continued to try to press DeVos to answer the question. And here's a cut from her.
What if they said, we are not accepting African-American students, but that was okay with the state? Do you see any situation where you would step in?
I think the Office of Civil Rights and our Title IX protections are broadly applicable across the board. But when it comes to parents making choices on behalf of their students...
This isn't about parents making choices. This is about use of federal dollars.
And here's DeVos's final answer.
We have to do something different than continuing a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach. And that is the focus. And states and local communities are best equipped to make these decisions and framework on behalf of their...
I am shocked that you cannot come up with one example of discrimination that you would stand up for students.
Tom, you're almost chuckling over there. What do you make of the exchange between DeVos and Clark?
It's almost like she had these talking points that she didn't know did not apply in this particular circumstance. Yeah, in education, one size doesn't fit all. Different curricula, different times, different schedules. That's great, of course. But there are some cases where one size does fit all, and that really does have to do with basic human rights. And why she doesn't get that difference. This is kind of settled law. Federal dollars do not go to places that discriminate. That's settled law. And she should have understood that. That's not something that's up to a locality or a state or something that's up to an individual school.
Mariama?
Well, you know, it's been so sad I've almost started to feel bad for her. But the reality is, at the end of the day, she really only knows about one thing. And that's a problem when you're in charge of education, which is, you know, a wide-ranging and complex system, and you only understand one thing.
And that one thing.
And that one thing is vouchers, mm-hmm. right? So I'm not against school choice. For instance, I went to an all-girls school. That was a great space for me, and I think there should be some possibilities for whom that might be a great option. But to say you're going to give money to a school that says, if you're gay, you can't come here. To say you can't even say that if a school openly discriminates by race, you won't. I mean, you can't be a one-trick pony when you're in charge of the entire education budget for the federal government.
No, I mean, this is almost why she didn't get confirmed, because she couldn't even give straight answers during the confirmation hearings. And you're just seeing this again. This woman just should not be the secretary.
You can be an activist. You can totally be an activist. Right. I, you know, some people have one thing they go out and fight their whole life for. Yeah. But you can't be in charge of an entire system and you don't even understand how it works or what the rules are.
Okay, let's move on this one. So on Sunday, let's talk about here closer to home. On Sunday, Mystic Valley Regional Charter School, I heard that sigh, Mariama.
Oh, yeah.
They punished two African-American girls for wearing braided hair extensions, but on Sunday, they suspended its ban for the rest of the year. Here's Alexander Dan, the interim director of the school's Board of Trustees, speaking to WBUR.
The Mystic Valley Regional Charter School Board of Trustees unanimously voted tonight to suspend the hair section of the uniform policy for the remainder of the school year. The school will continue to work with the Attorney General's office to ensure that the uniform policy reflects our longstanding commitment to the rights of all of our students.
The board's decision came 2 days after Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey asked the school to immediately end its ban on certain hairstyles that she said illegally singled out students of color. Colleen Cook is the mother of the twin girls who received detentions for their hair extensions. On Sunday, she told WBUR about her reaction to the board's decision.
I think we still have a long road to go, but I'm glad. I think what we did meet is that no more discipline and punishments will come to any girls. And if they do, hopefully we'll have recourse.
Mariama.
So I'm sad because I'm a black woman and I used to sit on a board of a charter school until a few months ago. So first of all, this represents a gross misunderstanding. So many young women get braids because they actually make hair simpler, not more difficult. I had braids in high school, and it was because we were going away, and it made it easier for me to do my hair. Our hair is just different. So it's not equality when you single out one type of hair and one type of hair expression and say, actually, we want you to conform to the same rules as another group that has a totally different hairstyle. And what it says to me is this group had no black women, apparently, that they could speak to and consult before this got this bad. I mean, did nobody reach out to someone? I've had conversations with this about this. My aunt all the way in Baltimore sent me this article and said, what is going on up in Boston?
Oh, I know. It spread throughout
social
media. All through
Facebook, yeah. Black women were like, this is just idiotic, right? I think the second piece that was challenging for me as a board member, a former board member, is when you're wrong, just say that you're wrong. Teach young people that, you know what, I thought it was this. I've now been educated to recognize it's this, and I'm just going to say I'm wrong.
But don't see, you're
stand
speaking
up and
about
say
something.
It's defendable in court. I mean, are you serious?
But what you're speaking to, I based on what their response, the letter home to parents,
yeah.
They don't believe.
Oh,
that
I know.
Wrong.
I read the letter.
Yeah.
And to me, and this is what I will say, we had an example where somebody brought up a bathroom policy where we had asked students not to go to the bathroom too many times. Because if you there's times where you raise your hand, I got to go to the bathroom, and you start to wonder, right?
Yeah.
But there are instances, for instance, where our middle school girls are having their first menstruation. And in that instance, it is not fair
that they have to
them
go, right? They
to
have to go
to the bathroom
times.
Less or go to the bathroom the same as the boys because the boys are not experiencing
right.
The same thing.
I want to get Tom into this.
It's not okay.
Get Tom, your response to this.
So two things. One is, you know, when you formulate these dress code policies, you need to actually be kind of reasonable in formulating the policies. And you do need to find out what's conventional and not conventional with the populations you're dealing with and understand how those policies might impact them. The other thing about this, though, is that apparently it was unequally enforced.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not supposed to mess with your hair, but apparently white girls who dyed their hair or colored their hair, they got away with that. So there really was two levels of issues here. One is, it seems to me that the policy itself is wrongheaded. But second, you also have to enforce policies equally across the board.
Okay, so really quickly, the Celtics lost. Are you guys brokenhearted? Are you sad? Happy?
I knew it was a long shot. I have to admit, after game three, I had a little bit of hope.
Yeah.
And my husband was there at the game last night. They even, moved his tickets up, and we were hoping. But I can't admit, I have to admit, I'm not altogether surprised.
I know, Tom.
It's not a surprise. I mean, I think everyone knew that this was a juggernaut here, and it was going to, and we know who the matchup was going to be. But I think the Celtics look like they could be well positioned for next year.
Yeah.
So that's what you got to hope for.
We
right?
saw a lot of good heart, and that bodes well. We have got a first draft pick. Who knows?
And a first draft pick.
Look at you guys. You're fans, right? You're not fair weather fans. That's great. Well, we didn't get a chance to talk about all the news, but this was a great conversation. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscetti, thanks for coming in. And Mariama White Hammond, minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. Thanks to both of you guys.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. Stay with us. There is more ahead. Coming up, we'll talk with WBUR's Asma Khalid about a new MIT study that finds consumers are losing confidence in self-driving cars. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Radio Boston. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. So you've probably heard someone in recent years tell you that autonomous vehicles are the future of driving. Companies like Google and Uber have begun testing cars that drive themselves, and some of those tests have been done right here in Boston. However, a new study out of MIT finds that a number of people are not all that interested in self-driving technology. Here to tell us more about the study and other news in tech this week is WBUR's Bostonomics reporter, Asma Khalid. Hi, Asma.
Hey, Tanya.
Okay, so what's happening here? I thought we'd all be excited to be able to listen to music and read books and stuff and not have to drive our cars.
So, Tanya, I guess a part of it maybe is about feeling in control. The survey asked about 3,000 people, and what's remarkable is that nearly half of them, 48%, said that they would never purchase a completely self-driving car. We spoke to Brian Reamer about this. He's a research scientist at the MIT Age Lab, which conducted this survey, and he pointed out that humans don't have experience really giving control over to a robot. You know, we're not really good at that. I mean, some people probably don't even like being in that passenger seat.
I believe that a lot of listeners will agree with this and understand this skepticism, especially here in Boston, because there is no grid here in Boston. When you're talking about the roadways, it's crazy. I mean,
and those aggressive drivers.
Right. Aggressive drivers. People thinking about being on the Jamaica Way at 5:30 in the afternoon, in the evening, and knowing what passengers, when they hop out of the MBTA bus and onto oncoming traffic, I mean, like all of it. I mean, it's just a mess. And so you think about having like these autonomous cars also in the mix, like,
yeah,
prone to accidents.
I think that there is some truth to that, right? But I think also, though, Tanya, it's the fact that some folks don't really trust the technology. And Brian Reamer over at MIT said that in part the reason that there is this lack of trust is that the companies working on developing this technology, right, they've been pouring billions of dollars into it, but they haven't necessarily been very transparent and public. And in order for consumers to really relinquish control, they need to feel safe. I think the question, as he told us, is what does that really mean?
Is there a certain target of half the accidents? Or we expect even something perhaps almost illogical? Automated vehicles should never even be involved in the most minor of crashes, hitting a curb. You know, what is the benchmark? Right now, humans look at robots and say they should be better than us. What is safe enough?
Right. I mean, Tanya, that is the question. What is safe enough? The study found that confidence in autonomous vehicles is down among all age groups.
Even millennials?
Even millennials, right? Even these people who have grown up using technology are addicted to their cell phones. So this is the second year that MIT has done this study, so they do have a sense of comparison. Last year, they found that about 40% of people between the ages of 25 and 34 said that they were comfortable with the technology. This year, that number is down to 20%.
Really?
It is, right? And so I think what's interesting about this is that millennials really do rely on technology. And so when I asked Brian about this, it seemed to say that he feels like people use technology, but they don't trust it, right? We're not willing to trust a cell phone with our lives because we know that our cell phones can fail. They are not 100% of the time working for us.
Right, right. We use them. We see their fails. We know that. So what does he think we need to do? Should companies just stop investing in self-driving technology?
He said no, not at all. He just thinks that there needs to be more transparency and so that the public feels like they can come along, right? Some of this feels like it's happening behind closed doors. There's not a good sense of what the risks are involved. He actually feels like if the public is aware, there is then this market, the public will feel sort of more confident in the process. And that's what he thinks needs to happen.
That's interesting. Okay, so let's switch gears to some other news this week. This one involves a possible merging of two sectors that are very important here in Boston, tech and finance. Here's a clip of Fidelity CEO Abigail Johnson speaking to an audience at a blockchain summit in New York earlier this week.
Some of you might be wondering, why am I here today? Well, I can tell you plenty of my colleagues back in Boston are asking the same question. I'm here because I love this stuff. Bitcoin, Ethereum, blockchain technology, all that the future might hold.
Johnson doesn't speak often, right, to the public.
No.
But she's really excited about this blockchain.
She is. And so first, Tanya, I should just briefly explain, you know, blockchain is essentially that underlying technology behind Bitcoin. It's the digital currency that made a big splash a few years ago. And evangelists say that it could do for finance what the internet did for communication, right? But you're right. I think what is mostly interesting about this all is just the sheer fact that we heard Abby Johnson, the CEO of Fidelity, talk. You know, she is famously private, and here she is giving a rare public talk, not at a finance conference, but at a blockchain confab.
Did she make any announcements about future plans to use tech at Fidelity?
So she said that she has this standing meeting at Fidelity where she gets updates on all the blockchain projects that are happening at Fidelity. But she also said that there are some major hurdles still, like privacy and usability.
Too often, we see Bitcoin and blockchain technologies as solutions in search of a problem. We don't just need these systems to be technically better. We need them to be more user-friendly.
And Tanya, what I think is like, I don't even think people care so much about what it was that she was saying about blockchain, but by her being there, she seemed to give this technology a sense of legitimacy. She's the CEO of Fidelity.
Right, right. Okay, so let's quickly go to something else that happened this week. Just yesterday, Mark Zuckerberg, another famous Bostonian or formerly Bostonian, the CEO and founder of Facebook, he was in town to give a commencement speech at Harvard, and you were there. He have to say to graduates?
So he talked to them about the need to live a life of purpose. But Tanya, I think maybe it's because I am so used to hearing politicians. But the thing that I think was most interesting is that at times this man who insists he is not running for higher office, he sounded like he was giving a bit of a stump speech. Here he is talking about income inequality.
Today, we have a level of wealth inequality that hurts everyone. Now, let's face it. There is something wrong with our system when I can leave here and make billions of dollars in 10 years, while millions of students can't even afford to pay off their loans, let alone start a business.
You know, what's really interesting about this, Asma, is he's notorious for not giving very good speeches. He's done well over the years. He's done better and better over the years. But you're right. He was poised. It sounded very much like a stump speech.
Right? Like who's talking about all these sort of potpourri of progressive public policies at a commencement speech?
Yes. Well, Asma Khalid leads our business and technology team, Bostonomics. You can follow them on Twitter at Bostonomics. Thank you very much, Asma.
You're welcome.
And since we just heard those political words from Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, we want to bring you some words from an actual politician this afternoon, speaking at Wellesley College.
You may have heard that things didn't exactly go the way I planned. But you know what? I'm doing okay.
That was former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking to graduates at her alma mater. And she updated the grads on what she's been up to since the 2016 election.
Long walks in the woods. Organizing my closets, right? I won't lie, Chardonnay helped a little too.
Secretary Clinton then got a little more serious. She remembered back to her own Wellesley commencement in 1969 when she addressed her class in the midst of Vietnam and a difficult political moment.
We were furious about the past presidential election of a man whose presidency would eventually end in disgrace with his impeachment for obstruction of justice. After firing the person running the investigation into him at the Department of Justice. But here's what I want you to know. We got through that tumultuous time. And once again, we began to thrive as our society changed laws and opened the circle of opportunity and rights wider and wider for more Americans. We revved up the engines of innovation and imagination. We turned back a tide of intolerance and embraced inclusion.
That inclusion and political change, Clinton said, came from the activism of young people staying true to their values. She set this as a challenge to the women of Wellesley.
So whatever your dreams are today, dream even bigger. Wherever you have set your sights, raise them even higher. And above all, keep going. Don't do it because I asked you to. Do it for yourselves. Do it for truth and reason. Do it because the history of Wellesley and this country tells us it's often during the darkest times when you can do the most good. Double down on your passions. Be bold. Try. Fail. Try again and lean on each other. Hold on to your values. Never give up on those dreams. I'm very optimistic about the future because I think after we've tried a lot of other things, we get back to the business of America. I believe in you with all my heart.
Inspirational words from Secretary Hillary Clinton earlier this afternoon at Wellesley College. Before we break, we want to bring you excerpts from one last powerful commencement address, this one from June 10th, 1963. It's part of WBUR's series marking the centennial of President John F. Kennedy's birth. WBUR's Kelly Horan takes us inside of JFK's peace speech, his commencement address at American University, which redirected the trajectory of the Cold War.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave.
It is hailed as one of the most important speeches of the 20th century, a call for world peace by a president who knows well how terrifyingly close America and the world had come to nuclear war.
I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on Earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
Our problems are man-made, Kennedy says. Therefore, they can be solved by man. This speech is a striking departure from Kennedy's previous Cold War addresses. And for an audience reared on Presidents Truman and Eisenhower's Cold War rhetoric, this message is entirely new.
Some say that it is useless to speak of peace, or world law, or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation.
In the months since the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, Kennedy and Khrushchev maintained a secret correspondence about nuclear disarmament. In a letter to the Soviet leader dated April 11, 1963, Kennedy writes, "Both you and I have grave responsibilities to our families and to all of mankind. The pressure from those who have a less patient and peaceful outlook are great. But I assure you of my own determination to work to strengthen world peace."
And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
In this speech, Kennedy announces upcoming test ban treaty talks in Moscow, and he heralds America's unilateral end of atmospheric nuclear testing. With our hopes go the hopes of all mankind, he says.
This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Those were excerpts from John F. Kennedy's commencement address at American University in Washington on June 10th, 1963. That story was produced by WBUR's Kelly Horn and originally aired in 2013. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Medford playwright and actor Obehi Janis has the unique ability to capture the precise tone of a setting. Her latest play is called Old White Sugar Daddy, and it's about a Boston startup in the middle of the venture capital scene. The main character develops an anti-gentrification app called Neighbor that drops the last vowel. And Janis taps into the difficult process of courting investors as a Black woman. Her play is part of the Boston Project, a new work initiative by the Speakeasy Stage Company. Obehi Janis joins us now in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So you're a writer, an actress, a comedian, and you're originally from Lowell.
I am.
What prompted you to write about the Boston startup scene?
Well, it's a really interesting journey. I was talking to some Black actresses, and we were actually joking about this tension between being Black, not having money, and, like, needing support. And we jokingly just talked about, you know, we need sugar daddies in a very joking way. And I remember saying, I'm going to write a play for all of you. And I run home, and I put in, like, Old White Sugar Daddy in my Google search. And, you know, a couple of interesting sites came up very much in the realm of sort of the escort scene. So I kind of put that idea in my Google Drive, what I call my Works in Progress folder. And a couple of years later, just started meeting so much more people in the startup industry of all colors and creeds and whatnot. But would really notice that when I talked to Black women who were either launching their startups or really in that kind of, you know, frustrating stage of just getting funding, you know, they were really frustrated. Mm-hmm. And I would ask them to tell me more about that. And I noticed that the way that I, as a Black female artist, talk about oppression is a little different than what they talk about. So that was why I decided to pursue it.
Well, you bring up something really interesting because African-American women make up about 0.2% of all VC funding. Mm-hmm. But looking at the 2011 census, they're also the most educated mm-hmm. and entrepreneurial group in the U.S. And the character, the main character in this piece, Lynn, puts a face on this statistic. I know that you haven't shown it. You're going to be showing it tonight. But
yeah, in progress.
And, yeah. When you brought this up to folks who were showing it during the ideation stages,
yes.
What were the reactions?
They pretty much said, Obehi, you are so accurate.
Mm.
So even with the little knowledge that I had, and this was actually pre-research. This was pre-me realizing that that statistic, those numbers are true.
Was actually a thing.
Yeah, it was actually a thing. I was just kind of writing from my head of just, you know, knowing my experience of creating and not always knowing where does the money come from. And then when I wrote it and then I would share drafts and just ask questions, they literally said, like, this is it. That I go to a meeting with the VC or I pray for a good angel investor that is not just just has like this opinion of me based on my color or based on how my name sounds or based on my hair, you know? So it all becomes, not to use a pun, but really coded in race and in gender simultaneously.
The main character, Lynn, is a Nigerian-American programmer who develops an app, an algorithm to tackle gentrification. Talk a little bit about this idea. It was funny. We talked about it in the morning meeting and everyone chuckled at the same time at this idea.
Just like I'm chuckling right now.
Right.
Dear God, I mean, so I went to school at Georgetown University, and I say that because being in D.C. from about 2005, 2009, I saw it. I saw it happening in real time, this structural racism, the actual pushing out of Black people from the center of D.C. to the outskirts. So when I moved back home to Lowell, and then I immediately also moved to Dorchester pretty quickly after that, I just kind of saw it. I would hang out with people in Roxbury, and they would talk about it. They're kind of like, you know, that's new. Or you'd be in Central Square, and all my friends who are Black and from Area 4 would be like, why is that bar there?
Mm.
And it's those tiny things. But now, 2017, it is full force, so much so that I actually think that the word gentrification is becoming mainstream because it's actually happening. It is now so much a part of the Boston-Cambridge-Somerville culture that it is so commonplace. Like, you can talk about it over coffee, like, any day of the week.
You have this line. There's a scene where Lynn describes the app and the algorithm, and she says, quote, "Our city on a hill is a lie. We are not excellent. We are flawed. From the Mayflower to busing, our progressive city is actually quite conservative and very backward." So, okay, the public hasn't seen this play yet, but, you know, people in Boston, they have reactions to themes that are directly hitting at the core of maybe some of the problems. We saw that with the Red Sox incident that happened.
Totally.
And
with Michael Che.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
With Comedian, when he said that Boston is a racist city. I would love to know just a little bit about why you felt it was so important to go right to the core of the problems that you see here in this city.
Of course. I think it is a POV problem. I've met Mayor Walsh in person. I think he's actually amazing. Great guy. But the reality is that his perspective as an Irish American, whatever generation he's from, is going to be immediately different from my perspective as a first-generation Nigerian-American woman who has Black friends, Caribbean friends. I have white friends. I have Italian-American friends. Like, on the ground, I am not only experiencing just the reality of what happens, but I'm also experiencing, like, the hurt. And the busing and this sort of puritanical thing, what essentially I'm trying to tease out is the fact that Boston is this interesting city of, like, culture and capital, but it's always, like busting up against each other. Mm. And you feel, as a woman of color, that it simmers. And I think that's the simmering that is frustrating, is that it's always the racism and the oppression. It's usually subtle, connected to what you said, what you're all talking about top of the show. I mean, those young women with the braids, I mean, I spent a day just sad. Like, my body physically
Your
was
personhood
hurting.
Was...
My personhood was affected because those young women were attacked for their hair, for their actual Black female body. So that's what I experienced.
Yeah, and you're talking specifically about the girls who go to the charter school.
Yes, exactly.
And who wore the braids to school, and they were suspended because of the braids. Mm-hmm. It was against the dress code. Talking about that simmer, you have a scene in the play where three white men are creating an app called Bodega, and you explore the cultural appropriation of that.
Yeah.
So while they were three white men and they're not Hispanic or anything in any way, they have this app called Bodega, and they say that it's an ode to you know, to folks.
Yes.
Why was it that an important theme for you to explore? It's really touching on what you said earlier.
I'm so glad, because honestly, as a self-proclaimed millennial, it is an issue. I mean, right now in Portland, Oregon, these two young white women just got shut down for their burrito.
That's
business.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
That's
so, like,
right. Yeah.
This is happening. I think that millennial hipster culture, which again can be coded as white, which is again a racial thing, you see it happening, that somebody's kind of like, I love my local bodega, but why do you love your local bodega? Like, don't just say that you're down. Don't try to perform a downness, but really listen to people of color and what they're saying. Or honestly, just stop doing this kind of, like, fake kind of appreciation. And I think that...
And let them do that.
And
thing.
Let them do it. You know what I'm saying? Or don't... Or, yeah, I just think that there is this kind of put-on-ness about it. So the Bodega app is that thing. And it does take a while for certain people, like the characters that you mentioned, to realize that it is not honoring a culture. It is actually completely stealing, and it's denigrating it.
So very quickly, with the time we have left, let's talk a little bit about you. So part of your work, we watched a TED Talk you did in 2015, TEDx Talk at Fenway.
Yeah.
And you said that when you write a play, you really try to get at the heart work. And we see a lot of these themes actually in this play, because so much of it is kind of a bit of you, your experiences, the women that you meet.
Yeah.
Why is it important to get to that heart work? You could write about anything.
Mm-hmm.
and not just your experience.
Of course. I do believe in transformation in the theater. I believe in empathy and relatability and, you know, the possibility of universality. But really, I think that my specificity of the heart work allows an audience member to feel something beyond themselves. So that's why I do that.
You're also funny. So we talked about the comedian. So you have this music video called Black Girl Yoga. I think we have a little bit of time to play the cut.
Okay.
I'm the only black girl in my yoga class. It's like an SNL skit, really.
Yeah,
it is.
I'm glad.
We talk a lot about these themes, about you wearing your satin scarf, mm-hmm. and you like feeling ostracized.
Yeah.
I think we could have this conversation forever, but we have to wrap it up. Obehi Janice is a Medford-based playwright and actor. Her play, Old White Sugar Daddy, will be performed in a free stage reading tonight as part of the Boston Project, a new works initiative by the Speakeasy Stage Company. We'll have more information on that on our website, radioboston.com. Thank you so much, Obehi.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for listening to Radio Boston. It's a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston.